With the new film Rise of the Planet of the Apes opening this weekend, we thought you might want to hear about the most famous ape movie of them all, King Kong, which was released in 1933.
What are you going to do?
I'll build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong! The eighth wonder of the world!
That was Robert Armstrong as Carl Denham, the producer who journeys to Skull Island in the Indian Ocean to capture the giant ape and bring him to New York to star in a theater spectacle. There are many things that make King Kong great. The special effects, the image of the giant ape climbing the Empire State Building, Fay Wray's screams, and the score composed by Max Steiner. In 1999, after the soundtrack of the film Dialogue and Music was released on CD, I spoke with film historian Rudy Belmer, who wrote the liner notes. We talked about how the film's director, Marion C. Cooper, used what was then state-of-the-art special effects. Cooper refused to use a man in a gorilla suit for King Kong, and so they went with, you know, the puppet and stop-time animation. Why didn't he want to use a man in a gorilla suit? It certainly would have been a lot easier.
Well, he felt that this had to be something different. And, of course, there had always been these men running around in gorilla suits in all kinds of movies that were made in the 20s and early 30s. And, you know, that was fine. But he wanted to do something special. And when he saw, over at RKO, Willis O'Brien, who was the chief technician, working on some stop-motion material for a picture called Creation, which was never made, and he saw these dinosaurs, he thought, wait a minute. Nobody's going to finance me during the Depression to go over to Africa and shoot a gorilla and then bring the gorilla to Komodo and so forth and so forth. When he saw that process at RKO, he thought, wait a minute, this is the way to do King Kong. So he wanted to do it via this stop motion, but to hedge his bet, he also had a huge full-size bust of Kong constructed and a hand and arm of Kong constructed, and a foot, so that for some shots, for example, when he's holding Fay Wray in his hand, you've got the hand. When you see an occasional close-up of the head, it's this big, oversized Kong. But he did not want to shoot a man in a gorilla suit. He just drew the line right there.
I've always thought that Kong's size and his, you know, relative size to buildings and people keeps changing throughout the movie.
You're absolutely right on that, Terry. It does keep changing. And this, once again, was people were saying, well, wait a minute. We built him on a scale of 18 inches to a foot, meaning that he'd be 18 feet high. Yet you want to make him, he said, I want to make him, for this scene, I want to make him bigger. I want to make him 24. And they all kind of looked at him like, I want to make him 24 feet. And then on occasion he said, forget the 18, the 24. I want to make him 45. You know? So it does keep changing. But he felt that the concept, when he got to New York, he definitely had to be bigger because of the environment. And, of course, Cooper was right. Cooper had to, you know, do a lot of fighting for things that he believed in. But inevitably, I found through the years, he was right.
Now, King Kong is really filled with a lot of bondage imagery, you know, Fay Wray in flimsy chiffon dresses and lingerie,
yes,
tied at the stake on the island or pulled out of her bed by Kong's giant arm in New York. Do you think that Cooper was intentionally playing to a kind of low-level bondage S&M kind of thing?
I don't think so. I think that he just thought this would be great material. You know, I don't think he ever gave thought to that sort of thing. He obviously wanted to use a woman, and he had not used a woman, really, in his documentaries. But he did want to use, and he did like Fay Wray. He had used her in Four Feathers, the Cooper Shudsack production of 29, and he used her in The Most Dangerous Game, which is a wonderful short story by Richard Connell that he was producing concurrently with King Kong at RKO. She was in that, and she was running around in the same jungle that she'd be shooting in the jungle during the day for The Most Dangerous Game and at night with Cooper for King Kong. And for King Kong, he wanted her in a blonde wig. She was actually a brunette, which she appears to be in The Most Dangerous Game. But he thought that the Beauty and the Beast bit, that the beauty should be a blonde. So she wore a blonde wig. And he was great friends with her and admired her, and they remained friends over the years.
What would you say the importance of Max Steiner's score is for King Kong? I mean, I love the score, but I find something very amusing about it, which is that although it's set on this island, Skull Island, the music is really very European and nothing like what would have been heard in the region at that time. And I'll play this scene in a moment, but, you know, when they first get to the island, when the American film crew first gets to the island and they're mm-hmm. watching this, you know, native ritual.
Yes.
The natives are chanting Kong, Kong, Kong. And there's this like march behind them as a kind of precursor of Kong's footsteps that will be marching toward,
yes.
toward his prey. And the march is a very European form and the brass instruments playing it are so European. And yet this defines a kind of, you know, South Sea Island or African kind of Hollywood sound.
That's true. Well, of course, Max and everybody else associated with this picture knew we were dealing with a fantasy here. It's a total fantasy. A more, as Cooper said, a more illogical picture could never have been thought up. And it is illogical if you stop and examine it from that standpoint. But the music, you know, they weren't saying, well, wait a minute, we have to get something that's indigenous to this area. We have to be authentic. We have to be like a documentary. And, you know, it was full reign of the imagination. And, of course, Max composed in a full Wagnerian manner, you know, with leitmotifs and with all kinds of percussive effects that could be used. And he just went all out. And the aspect of credibility, you forget about that because, once again, we're dealing in the world of fantasy, the ultimate world of fantasy.
Well, let's hear that scene where the film crew is observing this native ritual where the natives are chanting Kong.
What do you suppose is happening?
Oh, they're up to some of their heathen tricks. But don't go rushing out to sea.
All right, but isn't it exciting?
Sure. I wish we'd left you on the ship.
Oh, I'm so glad you did.
Well, it is you now. Wait till I see what goes on.
What a show. Hey, Skipper, come here and get a load of this. Ever see anything like that before in your life?
Pure musical delirium. really
and
it.
frenzy yeah, and delirium. Yeah. I think that would be a good team.
Well, the other memorable sounds in King Kong include, of course, Fay Wray's screams and the roar of Kong himself. Let's start with Fay Wray's screams. You know, in the movie, the Carl Denham character, the character who wants to, like, wrangle Kong and bring him back for a nightclub act, he says to the Fay Wray character, he's kind of like teaching her how to scream. And he says, okay, pretend you're screaming for your life, which, of course, she later has to do. Do you know what kind of advice Fay Wray was given about how she should scream?
Well, the interesting thing is that, of course, if she had done as much screaming when they were shooting this film as it appears to be, she would have been hoarse on the fourth day of shooting. Most of her screams were post-recorded. After the picture finished shooting, they took her into a sound booth, and she did wild screams. And they used those screams. So fortunately, she had one major screaming session, which once again was after the film finished shooting.
And of course, King Kong has a very memorable roar. What do you know about how that was achieved?
Well, a remarkable man by the name of Murray Spivak, who was the head of the sound department at RKO Radio Pictures at the time, he was confronted with this film, you know, and thought, what can I do? It can't sound like some animal. It has to be a distinctive sound. So he went out and he recorded the roar of a lion and the roar of a Tiger, and he was playing things at different speeds and playing them backwards and then combining them. And then even for some of Kong's grunts and things, he recorded himself doing in a little a megaphone type deal. So the sound is a kind of a combination of many things. It sounds like a roar, but it's not a roar that you can identify, which of course is what he wanted to do. But by altering the speeds of the recordings and taking two different animals and overlapping them, of course you can do all kinds of things.
Film historian Rudy Belmer recorded in 1999.